Good ignition on the second stage.
Can on the S2, it's looking good. Confirm EDS off.
EDS off, I call it here, sir.
Right.
Flight dynamics reports trajectory go at 3 minutes 9 seconds, downrange 81 miles, 46 miles high. Second plane separation, that's the skirt around the engines on the second stage.
Plane set.
And the launch escape tower has jettisoned.
Man, that staging was quite a sequence.
Right, sounded like it.
And we have guidance initiate.
We confirm that, 10.
Roger.
Yes, it is looking beautiful, Tom. Everything's copacetic.
Roger.
That's Charlie Duke talking to Tom Stafford.
Yeah, I bet.
Just like old times, it's beautiful out there.
You guys sound ecstatic.
Man, this is the greatest, Charlie. Charlie, bad, fantastic, babe, really.
That's Gene's surname with fantastic.
So you're a go, trajectory and guidance look good.
Yeah, Roger, we look right on the line on board.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. That was audio from Apollo 10 on May 18th, 1969, just after launch on the way to Earth orbit. We heard the voices of astronauts Tom Stafford, Gene Cernan, Capcom astronaut Charlie Duke in Houston, and NASA Public Affairs Officer Paul Haney. You can hear how happy and excited they are to get started on the second ever trip to the moon. As we close in on July 20th, 2019, and the 50th anniversary of the first lunar landing by the crew of Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong's one small step, which truly was a giant technological and historic leap, the first time a human being set foot on another world, here at Blue Dot, we want to take a step back to talk about the mission that came before, Apollo 10. It featured what I consider the finest astronaut crew of all time, Commander Thomas Stafford, Lunar Module Pilot Gene Cernan, and Command Module Pilot John Young. They were the first and only all-veteran crew of Project Apollo. Stafford had flown on Gemini 6 with Mercury 7 astronaut and Commander Wally Schirra, then with Cernan on Gemini 9. Young had flown on the first Gemini mission, Gemini 3, with Mercury 7 astronaut and Commander Gus Grissom, who was to die tragically in the Apollo 1 fire in 1967. John Young also flew with Apollo 11's Command Module pilot, Mike Collins, as the commander of Gemini 10. Another distinction of this crew is they were the only ones that would each command an Apollo mission. Stafford on 10, Young on 16, and Cernan was the last man on the moon as the commander of Apollo 17 in December of 1972. A further distinction for Young is that he would go on to command the maiden flight of the space shuttle Columbia, as well as the sixth flight of the orbiter in 1983. Columbia, of course, would tragically disintegrate, killing all seven astronauts on board when attempting to re-enter Earth's atmosphere in 2003. So this was an amazing crew by any measure, as was the mission. To take the first pair of spacecraft, the Command Service Module and the Lunar Module, out to the moon in a full dress rehearsal of the moon landing that would take place just 2 months later. Plus, the two spacecraft launched from the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral in Florida on May 18, 1969, had the most amazing names. Charlie Brown for the Command Module and Snoopy for the Lunar Module, named, of course, for the famous Peanuts comic strip characters created by the late Charles Schulz. Along the way, the astronauts would test all the hardware and software that Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins would need to rely on for their successful landing on July 20th, 1969. And it didn't all go according to plan. There were plenty of glitches, from communications to the water filtration system, and a famous moment when the lunar module briefly spun out of control due to an incorrect switch setting. But have no fear, space history fans, the guy who truly had the right stuff, in fact, number one in his class at Edwards Air Force Base, the man from Weatherford, Oklahoma, Tom Stafford, was at the controls and all was corrected, further paving the way for the historic success of Apollo 11. In this program, as we look back at Apollo 10, which is absolutely one of my favorite Apollo missions of all time, will talk to Lieutenant General Thomas Stafford. He's 88 years young and the last surviving member of the crew, as Gene Cernan passed away in 2017 and John Young almost left us exactly a year later in January of 2018. We'll also hear from General Stafford's longtime friend and fellow Oklahoman, Bill Moore, who will give us some perspective on this truly iconic American hero. But first, let's hear about the mission from what it was like to work behind the consoles of the famed Mission Operations Control Room in Houston, Texas. Our guest is Jerry Griffin. Griffin was the director of NASA's Johnson Spacecraft Center from 1982 to 1986, but before that, he was one of the legendary flight directors during the golden age of American space exploration, including Project Apollo. He joined us via Skype from Houston. Jerry Griffin, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and we're talking about the 50th anniversary of Apollo 10. And before we really get into that, I saw something that kind of fascinated me, is that you were born, and I think you're a twin, you were born on Christmas Day, right?
That's correct. Christmas Day in 1934, and my twin brother is Larry, and he lives right down the road, as a matter of fact.
Gosh, I was thinking about that, because I was born on December 30th, and I remember, you know, as a kid growing up, it was always, this is your Christmas and birthday present. So I'm thinking it had to be even worse for you guys.
Yeah, it was. Although I think some people remembered us because we were twins born on Christmas. So we probably got some gifts we wouldn't have otherwise gotten for our birthday. It may have evened out in the long run.
Well, you were born in Texas, and then of course you got to come back to work at the Johnson Space Center, you know, Mission Control in Houston. Could you just briefly tell us about the path that led you to become a flight controller?
Yeah, sure. I graduated from Texas A&M University with a degree in aeronautical engineering. I was also ROTC, so I was commissioned in the Air Force when I graduated. And it turned out that I had a commitment of, it turned out it's 4 years. It started out at three. So I was in the Air Force. I was flying in the backseat of F-101s, not very far from where you are, at Hamilton Air Force Base in Marin County.
Oh.
And I flew there. And during that period is when NASA was formed. And shortly, just about the time I was about to get out, is when Kennedy gave his speech that we were going to go to the moon. Although I wasn't in the space program yet, I remember thinking, I got to be a part of that. So I finally weaved my way to NASA in 1964, and I went immediately into mission control. I was a guidance, navigation, and control systems guy. And I did that for all of the Gemini program. I was getting ready to do it for Apollo when the fire occurred. In fact, I was in the control center that night when the fire occurred, and of course it was a big shock, and it stopped the program for 22 months. In that interim period between the fire and Apollo 7, my boss, Chris Kraft, decided that he needed three more flight directors. And so he reached down in the ranks of people under him, and I was one of the ones he plucked out and said, you're going to be a flight director for Apollo.
Well, let's talk about Apollo 10. You were one of the flight directors. I think Glenn Lunnie was the lead director, as I recall. And then there was you, Milton Windler, and Pete Frank. And you all have color designations, like I think the black, gold, maroon, orange, colors like that. Can you kind of tell us how that rotation worked on a flight like Apollo 10?
Yeah, Apollo 10, actually, give me a second. You got to go back to 8, 10, and 11 were a little bit unique. Those were our first times out at the moon. The first time on Apollo 8 with just the command module, then Apollo 10, we had both a command module and a lunar module. Those first three flights to the moon, we actually had five flight directors and four teams. We put two flight directors on the first ship. So I was sitting, if you can find some pictures of me around, I'm sitting with Glenn Lunnie, And what we did is kind of, for those first missions, we knew we were going to be busy because, and particularly when we were going on to the moon, with translunar injection coming, that's the maneuver that sent you off to the moon, coming soon after launch. You had the Saturn launch followed by the translunar injection, and it was a busy, busy time. So we just figured it was good to double up with a couple of heads on that flight director console for that early going.
Well, Apollo 10 is it's always characterized as this dress rehearsal. It's the first time you've got a lunar module and a command module going out to the moon, orbiting the moon and separating. And can you talk a little bit about some of the highlights for you as a flight director and of some of the, you know, the problems that came up that you had to solve along the way? Could you maybe tell us a couple things about some of the problems you had to go through solving?
Yeah, actually, every mission, and I guess this goes clear back to my first days as a flight controller in the Gemini program, every mission had problems, and some got pretty serious and some not so serious, but it seemed like there was always something that was nagging at us. And we had some problems that happened where you had to respond in a hurry, and then others, you could be a little slower. And Apollo 10 was actually a very clean mission. There was a lot of little things that went on, like you mentioned the water chlorination. I don't think they liked the taste of the water after they chlorinated it. And if you'll recall from that transcript, Tom Stafford wasn't real sure he wanted to chlorinate it. He thought he had an agreement. I was looking at that stuff the other day for another purpose, and he was hoping they wouldn't have to chlorinate it, but they finally, the doctors overruled him and said, yeah, you better do it. So he did it.
Well, as I recall listening to it, it was kind of, the water was getting chlorinated, you know, right when they were about to drink it. So they were just getting this heavy dose of chlorine. It was like, you know, can't we rechlorinate this while these guys are sleeping? And we're trying to work that out for them.
Yeah, and sometimes we always kind of wondered about some of the timing that the doctors did like that, and you know, couldn't you let them go for a while? But you know, they followed their rules pretty carefully, and I think it kept us out of trouble. Biomedically, all the guys performed well. Those last three missions with the rover, they got awfully tired because those were long, long excursions out on the moon. But back to 10 really was a dress rehearsal. But the neat thing about 10 is that we had actually, it was pretty logical. You know, we went to the moon on Apollo 8 with just a command module. Then we flew a command module and a lunar module. On 9, we flew that in Earth orbit. So we learned a lot about the dynamics of the two vehicles right there. And the big thing we did, by the way, is proved we could separate the two of them. And we backed the lunar module off about 100 miles and then did a rendezvous that worked. So that gave us a lot of confidence that we had something that would work at the moon as well. It shouldn't be any different. It's kind of a dress rehearsal. And by the way, that I often get the question, why didn't you go ahead and land 10? Well, that lunar module was too heavy.
Yeah.
It was not a worthy spacecraft to land. So we knew we weren't going to land, but we did everything but that. And we proved again that we could rendezvous and get all of that solved out at the moon as well as we did at the Earth.
Can I jump in and pose a hypothetical for you?
Sure.
Let's say that it was light enough to land. Do you think it was still, you know, be that as it may, it was really valuable, all of the data you collected and the procedures that you learned to get all the kinks worked out before you tried to land with Apollo 11?
Amen. I think even if 10 had been light enough for a landing and an ascent after that, I think 10 made sense to do what we did.
What I loved about that mission was the call signs for the command module being Charlie Brown and the lunar module being Snoopy. You know, it's just so fun to listen to. I've been listening to it late at night where it's just like, Charlie Brown, do you read? And you're waiting to hear John Young reply. And it just sounds so fun, you know, when you're listening to Snoopy and Charlie Brown talking to Houston.
We had two of those, Dave. We had Charlie Brown and Snoopy on 10. We also had a Spider and Gumdrop on 9, which I thought was another cute one that it rang a bell.
And Casper on 16.
Yeah, yeah.
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Yep.
And then, you know, as a nine-year-old back then, that, you know, that just enthralled me. I was in love with the space program to begin with. But, you know, when the spacecraft are named after my favorite Peanuts characters, you had me sucked in for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Gotcha.
There was, you know, of course, there's two, you know, kind of famous things about Apollo 10. And I'm wondering if you could talk about it from a flight director's point of view. There was that moment when they are firing the ascent engine and lose a little bit of control briefly. And you read some of the things on the internet, it's like, oh, they almost crashed into the moon. And, you know, when you actually go through it, it's not quite that dire, you know, especially when you got a test pilot like Tom Stafford, number one in his class at Edwards Air Force Base, by the way. When you got somebody like him at the helm, you're pretty sure things are going to get under control. But, you know, what was that like from a flight director's point of view when they did have some problems there?
Yeah, you know, that wasn't totally unexpected, but it always worried us when we saw oscillations or something that we didn't understand. If you'll notice, even on the SN engines, that when we finally got a picture of them from the moon, there was quite a bit of instability as it was going up. It was kind of wallowing around.
Mm-hmm.
And even on 13, Apollo 13, where we had to burn the descent engine when it was still connected to the command and service module, and we got some wild excursions there, and that was because of the fact that you had two vehicles connected together with different orientations. One of them was looking one way and one was looking the other. And it made it extremely difficult to control. But Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes on that flight finally figured it out and got we call it the transfer function, got it down to where they could control it. But those maneuvers were always, now when you were by yourself in the command and service module, that service propulsion system was like a rock. I mean, it never wavered much. But the lunar stuff did. I never knew why. We finally kind of got used to it. The autopilot was obviously a little looser, but the engine was very, very smooth. I noticed many times in the transcript it was in the mission report that Tom Stafford talked about how smooth the engine accelerated on both the ascent stage and the descent stage. But there was some kind of, I'm sure they didn't feel comfortable. By the time we actually could see it and do much about it, the burn was usually over. So we were kind of dumb without knowing it. But I think the crew really did recognize the oscillation. They could feel it.
Yeah. At the end of Apollo 10, you know, with it being such a success and with such an incredible crew, you know, the all-veteran crew of Stafford and John Young and Gene Cernan, and also, and I like to point this out to people, this is the only crew of all commanders, because, you know, each one of them commanded an Apollo mission, and Stafford commanded two when you count Apollo Soyuz. So, you know, just to me, the most amazing crew of all. When it was all said and done and they had splashed down in the Pacific, how confident were you guys that on the next mission you were going to land on the moon with Apollo 11?
I think I was very confident. It's a risky business. And I think realistically, we all knew there was, you know, a good chance you were not going to make it. But on the other hand, we had been at it now for 8 years almost. And we had seen that hardware perform, in Earth orbit and at the moon. And I think all of us felt if we can't do it now, we're not going to do it. We've got the systems, we've got the experience in operating them, and now is the time. And I felt pretty confident. And, you know, the thing about it, Dave, now that I think about it, I can recall, we always just kind of took one step at a time. And I remember thinking at the end of 10, well, now we've got to launch from Earth. We got to launch Apollo 11. Mm-hmm. And so it was always kind of just take that next step and take it one at a time. Don't get too far ahead of yourself. Just kind of take what's right in front of you. It's kind of like a golfer. Just hit that shot. Don't worry about the shot after it hit the one you got to make right now. And I remember thinking that way.
Jerry, what are the lessons from Apollo now that we're 50 years on that you think, you know, when you talk to people, that this is something that you lived through, I lived through, but for so many today, like for perhaps, you know, the children in your family, you know, this is all kind of ancient history to them. What are some of the lessons from Apollo do you think that are applicable to today's world?
Well, I think the biggest lesson that we probably got out of it, and it took me a while to kind of get to this conclusion because I was in the middle of it and just didn't have time to think about it, but it showed what can be done when you set a goal and have a common agreement and a purpose to reach it. This country has performed always well when it had that set of circumstances, like World War II and like Apollo. It decided that we're going to be all in it, and we're going to make it work, and we're going to get there. And by the way, during that time, we had Republicans and Democrats. We had two Democrat presidents and one Republican, and they never wavered in their support. We had the Congress that was split at one time, came together, and I think split again between Republican and Democrat, and the support never wavered.
Well, on that amazing note, I'm going to have to let you go. And I just so appreciate you spending the time with us today. It's a joy to talk to you about Apollo 10, which is one of those missions that just doesn't get enough attention. This was an amazing mission. So many firsts had to be accomplished. So much had to get worked out. And like I said, most of it all little things that you fixed along the way that ultimately led to that one small step in July 20th, 1969. So thank you so much, not only for today, but for your service to our country. And that's ongoing, I know. So I really appreciate what you do and what you've done.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. And give my best to Tom when you talk to him.
Thanks to our guest, Apollo Flight Director Jerry Griffin. Before we go on break, let's listen to a bit of the mission audio as Gene Cernan and his commander Tom Stafford experience a few tense moments as the lunar module Snoopy is out of control about 50,000 feet above the surface of the moon after rehearsing the approach maneuvers that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin would have to maneuver 2 months later. I'm Dave Sloan, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
Something's wrong here. Hold it, Gino.
Okay.
Something's wrong with that YRH arrow. Let's go in pings and attitude hold.
Okay, you ready?
Okay. Go
ready?
Thrust aft. Hold it. Thrust aft. Go to pings. God damn.
Okay, let's make this burn on the eggs, babe.
We're in trouble.
I'm Dave Sloan, and you are listening to Blue Dot's Look Back at Apollo 10. Our next guest is one of my greatest personal heroes, and it was both an honor and a thrill to get to talk to him. Lieutenant General Thomas Stafford is one of America's most accomplished astronauts. The Weatherford, Oklahoma native was a member of the second group of nine astronauts selected by NASA in 1962, and he flew into space four times. When we caught up with him, he was meeting with a group of Russian space representatives to continue the U.S. agreements with them in operating the International Space Station. which is fitting since it was Stafford who commanded the first ever joint space mission between two countries, the Apollo-Soyuz test project with the then Soviet Union in 1975. But of course, we want to talk to him about commanding Apollo 10. General, I'd like to start out by welcoming you to Blue Dot to talk about Apollo 10.
No, that was, I guess, my most impressive mission of the four I flew, even though each one was completely different. And the toughest one I flew was Gemini 9, but Apollo 10 was, to me, the most impressive.
Before we talk about the mission itself, I'd like you to tell us about your crewmates. For me personally, as a student of history and the space program, I feel like, and I'm not just saying this to you, that was perhaps the greatest crew ever assembled. You know, all three of you commanded Apollo missions. Can you tell us a bit about your crewmates, Gene Cernan and John Young?
Well, sure. I had the most experience crew of any of the Apollo missions that flew. I'd flown twice in Gemini. John Young had flown twice in Gemini. Gene Cernan once in Gemini. So we had five flights between us and no other crew had it.
Yeah, and they both went on to command Apollo missions, 16 for John Young, and of course the last mission to the moon, Apollo 17.
Young commanded Apollo 16, and Cernan commanded the last one, Apollo 17.
Well, let's talk about the mission itself, because it really did pave the way for the landing on the moon in July. Going into it, can you just give us, what were the main objectives for Apollo 10?
Well, the main objective was to take the lunar module out to the moon for the first time, to separate from it. I was too heavy to land, or I might have had a chance to land with decent, powered decent software on the lunar module and worked out. It was still iffy, which it wasn't, and the thing was too heavy. And they had a program to cut weight out the best they could from the decent module. And they started on mine, but it wasn't much. And they did it on Neil's, but Neil, he landed with 17 seconds of fuel, which was Apollo 11. And I wouldn't have had any fuel left. So main thing was to separate and also track from the Earth the two spacecraft, and then separate, go down a series of passes, and over the proposed landing side ellipse, and do the best we could with the Hasselblad with the highest resolution we could get. Film it, radar map it, visually look at it, and do that several times. And then come back and do the first rendezvous in space, work out all the procedures that's needed to do a lunar landing, except the last 50,000 feet down, been on the surface 50,000 feet up. Because I remember I told my buddy Neil, I said, okay, here you are, partner. I said, here are all the procedures. Launch on the Earth, around 1.5 orbits, translunar injection, and what you have to do for passing the cooling all the way to the moon. You barbecue the moon, you don't keep one attitude. And that's to dissipate heat, get out there, lunar orbit insertion. All the procedures.
One of the things that I've been listening to all of the audio from the mission for the last week, and I remember this mission quite well as a 9-year-old. I loved the call signals for the two spacecraft. How did it get decided that it was Charlie Brown and Snoopy for the LEM?
Okay. Well, at the time, NASA came up with a program to motivate people for quality control, do good workmanship, and really help, because we had 400,000 people working on the Apollo program. And to do that, and somebody came up, we got permission from Charles Schultz, who drew a peanut for Snoopy. It's called a little silver Snoopy award put on your lapel pin. And the organization and individual has done outstanding work. It was a real motivating factor to give us. In fact, they had the few of the astronauts, senior astronauts, making the awards at times. So You know, I was actually starting to think, because we needed call signs. The first one, we had two bands of spacecraft. You know, all at the same time was Apollo 8, pardon me, Apollo 10, 9. And that was McDivitt, Scott, and Schweikert. And a command module and service module. And they called theirs Gumdrop and Spider. Well, I wanted to honor all the people who had worked so hard and put in such good work in there, so we call it Snoopy. See the lunar module go down and snoop around the moon. So it would just spell out, you know, that's Snoopy, then the command module would be Charlie Brown.
One of the things that also struck me is, as I recall when I was a kid watching that mission, was this was the first time I got to see color TV from space. Can you tell us about how did that come about, where you got the first color TV camera on Apollo 10?
You always have to think out of the box and be a driver. And so as soon as I got the mission, knew what it would be. And I asked, what about, you know, I said, you know, space, look down on the Earth, two Earth orbit missions I've done. I knew it was going to be awesome when flying out to the moon and around the moon. And I said, when's the color TV? How can you get color TV? He said, we have a program. It'll be ready in 3 years. And I said, baloney, since we're on video, I said a few other words too. And so I knew General Sam Phillips so well. Of course, the program manager, Joe, I said, what about if I put together a Skunk Works team? We kind of get some hand-built things. You get a hand-built color TV. It could go on there. They said, have at it. They knew it'd be brilliant because color TV was really coming in the late 60s. And there's only three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. And, you know, having color TV is, most people still had black and white. And so, determined that they had as one member of the team determined that you put a Vidicon part. There's a low light level Vidicon was classified in Vietnam being used. So I got a hold of General Phillips, said, I'm like getting two of those units declassified. So boom, it was done instantly. And there were, for some reason, only in France they had five lenses, variable, you know, focal length lens, that had what we needed, and we got those two over. But then how do you get color? And so, I remember what the TV sets used to look like. Now everything is flat screen. Well, you had three color guns. You had three basic colors, red, blue, yellow. But there's no way we could have big color guns like that in spacecraft. And one of the members said, hey, when they first invented color TV, rudimentary, but they had a color wheel, had a wheel with little squares of red, blue, and yellow. Why don't we get one of those and we rotate it, just like they did. So think simple. And so we got the little motor of a Merriman missile doing some actuation. And they had Westinghouse, which was building some TVs, but they weren't known for them. They weren't the big RCA or Philco's or like that. So we had Westinghouse, really the Westinghouse Defense Systems, hand-built two cameras and a ground kind of decoder. So it would rotate in mission control. We had a color wheel rotating with the scribe, and it would sync with the scribe when the signal were done. So we built that in 3 months. It worked. It was put on board the spacecraft about a week and a half before we launched. And we had more primetime color TV than any other Apollo mission. Those people just hadn't seen that. And what amazed me was how good it came to, because when we turned around on the way out to the moon and docked with the lunar module, you could see the rivets on the top of the skin of the lunar module. In fact, you know, we're feeling so good that Mission Control said it was just absolutely fantastic. The world was saying. So I was feeling pretty high. And before I went to bed that night, I said, look, you can see this beautiful round blue, white, a little bit of land on it, a ball. So I said, be sure to send a message to the president of the British Flat Earth Society in London and tell him that they're wrong. You can see right here on live color TV, the Earth is round. Next morning, I woke up. And so then the Earth was smaller, between the size of a basketball and soccer ball. And so the second news article they read up was from the president of the British Flat Earth Society, the Colonel Savard. He said he certainly saw the beautiful color TV pictures of saw it was a round Earth, but it was still right. It was a round, flat disk.
Oh, my. And those people are still around and still crazy. I loved the color television. I remember we had just gotten, in 1969, our first color TV in my house. And I believe it was a Zenith. And it was just so spectacular to see the Earth broadcast by you guys. And in the interior of the spacecraft, it was, for a nine-year-old me, it was enthralling. And so thanks for that.
Yeah, well, one thing I didn't realize, and I didn't do it for any award, but before that, my team received an Emmy, so each one got an Emmy. So I went to New York for the National Emmy Awards, the gala they had. So I took General Phelps with me because he backed me 100%. And so I received the Emmy for the team. I gave us one for each one of us. So it worked out real well. So I won an Emmy.
Well, one other moment of the mission that always gets written about, and I'd like you to kind of set the record straight on this, is when you were separating from the descent stage after you'd gone down there to 47,000 feet and were getting ready to come back and rendezvous with the command module with John Young, there was that few moments of some kind of wild gyrations. And you know, you see some of these headlines on the internet that, you know, Apollo 10 almost crashed into the moon. Could you just kind of briefly set the record straight on that? How bad was that, actually?
Well, what happened? We're going face down backwards, you know. And we're going to stage the descent stage, fire the ascent stage, and that'll bring the Apple down to where we then start to see, because we're drifting further behind John Young, and then that would start back up. And then about a minute before, maybe a minute, 15 seconds, the thrusters started to occasionally fire. And I noticed I had on the weight needles, I had a yaw rate on the needle, but I looked at the 8-ball, and it wasn't yawing. And I could tell by the surface of the moon as we're going into the darkness, it wasn't yawing. We weren't yawing. So I said, what the heck is this? And it looks like I had a yaw rate gyro thing. And then also at that time, a yellow warning light came on. That was an electrical bus. And so I started troubleshooting at the wrong switch. We went over to abort guidance switch, which aims you at the command module. So it flipped around, but we only had a 3-gimbal platform. And so I didn't want to lock up the gimbals on our primary system, which you could do. Where Germany had a 4-gimbal platform, you could yaw 90 degrees, either way it wouldn't hurt you. But generally, you yawed 90 degrees, the gimbal locked up, tumbled. And so I wanted to avoid that, so I went to manual control, went to the hard stops, and flew around, and finally got it under control. But I kept avoiding those 90-degree yaws, which is a no-no. In fact, the 8-ball had big red round circles on both sides. And anyway, and then I got it back into right near where the primary position was before. We were still in local Arizona. I went back to the primary guidance, just loaded a couple of degrees, got there, so all squared away. And so then we made the maneuver, because I wasn't about to make a maneuver that close to the moon with only 1/6 gravity of the Earth. And so we got us there and made the maneuver right to center of hook for a second, and squared away, and so they brought the Appaloosa down and started to catch it.
Wow. And Snoopy, the ascent stage, is the only surviving lunar module that still exists. It's Charlie Brown, of course, is in a museum in London, I believe. And Snoopy's out there orbiting the sun. If we could go out to see Snoopy and look inside, what would we see in there? What were your last recollections of what we would see if we went inside of Snoopy and were to find it someday in the future?
Well, Charlie Brown is in the British Museum of Science off Knightsbridge. But the Snoopy ascent stage is the only ascent stage that is still, you know, up there as safe as in a wild heliocentric orbit. And he comes back every 40,000 miles. So about 40 or 50,000 miles, it will swing above the moon, and then it goes out above the sun. So it goes out 270 or 280 miles.
Wow! And what would we see if we went inside of it now? What was left inside there?
The command module. We started, so that didn't need that anymore. We had a lot of empty food bags, a lot of water, full of water bags. And Sophia, garbage, because we use Snoopy as a garbage dump.
Sounds kind of like my garage.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, before we let you go, because I know you've got a meeting to get to, what is it about Oklahoma that has given us so many great astronauts? There's you, Gordon Cooper, one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, Fred Hayes, who famously was on Apollo 13, William Pogue, I'm probably forgetting Shannon Lucid. What is it about Oklahoma that produces so many astronauts?
Well, I don't know, I guess. There's always a work ethic, at least. Well, I grew up out in Western Oklahoma by the Dust Bowl, and most Oklahomans like to work hard, and I think fairly smart, so they always like to achieve goals and work hard.
Thanks so much for spending the time with us today and sharing your memories of Apollo 10.
Right. Hey, it's great to talk to you.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our look back at Apollo 10 50 years ago in May 1969. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to My Childhood Heroes on Blue Dot. Our next guest is Bill Moore. He is a space historian from Oklahoma and also a close personal friend of Tom Stafford. And we want to talk to him about his take on General Stafford as we look back on Apollo 10 50 years ago. Bill, how did you meet General Stafford?
Well, I had appeared at different banquets and whatnot around the state, and he would be there as well, and we would talk. But I really didn't get to know him until the mid-90s when I approached him about producing a documentary about his career for our state's PBS station, OETA.
And how did you actually, you know, you told me a pretty cool story about how you actually connected with him. I think, was it his wife that kind of helped you out?
That's right. That's right. I was videotaping a program in Weatherford, Oklahoma, his hometown, and they were actually dedicating a building to him. And I thought, well, I brought an outline of what I wanted to do for the program, and so I asked you know, the folks there, if it'd be okay to present it to him. They said, sure. Well, foolishly, I thought I could get close to him, not in his hometown. I mean, when it was over, it was just like 50 people around him, and I watched him walk down this hall away from me, and I thought, well, I have to figure something else out. Turned around, looked, and there was Mrs. Stafford, Linda, sitting there, and I went and introduced myself and told her what I was wanting, and she said, well, I'll take it to him, and next morning he called. So I learned a valuable lesson.
Tell us a bit about Weatherford, Oklahoma, because he's got, well, there's the most wonderful Air and Space Museum. You would never think this as a person from California, that one of the best Air and Space Museums in the country you could visit is in Weatherford, Oklahoma. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it started out as a display case in the airport in Weatherford. And they asked General Stafford there at his hometown if he would mind donating a few items. And next thing you knew, they decided they'd like to add on this small room. And so they brought in some exhibit designers, and they made a nice little extra room onto the airport. And it's expanded from there. It's at least 40,000 square feet now and currently growing again. There's a legacy program of expansion going on right now. So you'll find full-scale replicas of, like, the command and service module. There'll be a full-scale replica of the lunar module once the expansion's finished. A lot of the jets he's flown, including a MiG Russian fighter, signed by Alexei Leonov. Of course, General Stafford has brought his friends from Russia to visit, and they've been at several banquets there. Small town, it's a college town. And it's where he was born and raised, right on the main road of Route 66. He used to watch an airplane fly over, he may have told you, when he was a young boy. It was a DC-3. It had a regular route, and he watched it every day, and he dreamed about flying. That's when it started.
Tell us a little bit about him as a person, from your experiences with him over the year. What are some of the qualities about Tom Stafford that really stand out in your mind?
Probably that he's a down to earth kind of guy, which is funny for someone who's been to the moon. He's brilliant, very sharp memory. He's just a great guy. He's loyal to his friends, to his hometown, to his home state. He's a hero. He answered his country's call, both here on Earth and in space. He flew four missions into space on Gemini 6, Gemini 9, Apollo 10 that we're celebrating in May, and the Apollo Soyuz mission, which opened up our cooperation with the Russians in space, which paved the way for flights on the Mir space station and then, of course, today's International Space Station. Without his Apollo Soyuz mission in 1975, those might not have happened.
Well, and you know, that's interesting, because when I spoke to him the other day, the funniest thing that he said, it struck me as hilarious. It was just like, well, I got to go because I got a room full of Russians over here that are waiting on me. And so I was like, yes, General, we'll
that's
let
right.
you go talk to
that's
the
right.
Russians.
It's Russia has been very prominent in his life, both professional and personal. He served on a lot of committees on the space station, working with the Russians. And then in his personal life, he asked Alexei Leonov, the commander, the Russian or the Soviet commander back in 75 on that Apollo Soyuz mission, to help him. He wanted to adopt a couple of Russian boys. And so Alexei Leonov paved the way for that. Michael and Stas came over. They were probably about 8-10 years old, something like that, and have grown into fine young men. And just it's amazing the opportunity they were presented.
Wow. And it was interesting is that he's still instrumental in getting the agreement signed between the Russian Space Agency and NASA. He's doing this in a professional capacity still.
Very much so. And he'll turn 89 this year. So, yeah, pretty amazing.
Thanks so much for listening to our look back at Apollo 10, the voyage of Charlie Brown and Snoopy to the moon with astronauts Tom Stafford, Gene Cernan, and John Young on board in May 1969, the dress rehearsal for the lunar landing that would take place in July of that year with Apollo 11. When you hear the audio clips from the mission, or any clips from Apollo missions to the moon, you probably notice the distinctive beep-beep tones that sound like this. I asked Jerry Griffin about them, and they're called Kindar tones, and a means by which remote transmitters on Earth were turned on and off so the capsule communicator, the Capcom like Charlie Duke in Houston, could communicate clearly with the crews of the spacecraft. Thanks also to my friend Simon Plumpton, aka Lunar Module 5 from YouTube, for his incredible work in uploading nearly all of the audio and video simulations along with the TV broadcasts of the Apollo 10 mission, which we used to research this episode. You can check it out on YouTube and we'll provide a link on our website. Simon is currently working on the Apollo 11 mission, and you can vicariously join the crews of these Apollo missions to the moon for just about every minute from liftoff to splashdown. And especially, thanks to our wonderful guests, Lieutenant General Thomas Stafford, commander of Apollo 10 and one of the great heroes of the golden age of space exploration, Jerry Griffin, who also played a vital role in Project Apollo as one of NASA's legendary flight directors at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. And thanks to Bill Moore from the Oklahoma Historical Society and good friend of Tom Stafford's. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. And a very special thank you to our producer and engineer, Mr. Blue, Sky Schofield. Sky is leaving us for a career herding electrons in Portland. He has made this show sound great for the past year, and we will dearly miss him and wish him well. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. Hey, let's go out with a song that the astronauts took with them and actually played while in lunar orbit on Apollo 10.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words,